My Bondage and My Freedom by Frederick Douglass. The Slavery Party, an extract from a speech delivered before the American Anti-Slavery Society in New York, May 1853. Sir, it is evident that there is in this country a purely slavery party, a party which exists for no other earthly purpose but to promote the interests of slavery. The presence of this party is felt everywhere in the Republic. It is known by no particular name and has assumed no definite shape, but its branches reach far and wide in the church and in the state. This shapeless and nameless party is not intangible in other and more important respects. That party, sir, has determined upon a fixed, definite, and comprehensive policy toward the whole colored population of the United States. What that policy is, it becomes us as abolitionists, and especially does it become the colored people themselves, to consider and to understand fully. We ought to know who our enemies are, where they are, and what are their objects and measures. Well, sir, here is my version of it, not original with me, but mine, because I hold it to be true. I understand this policy to comprehend five cardinal objects. They are these. First, the complete suppression of all anti-slavery discussion. Second, the expatriation of the entire free people of color from the United States. Third, the unending perpetuation of slavery in this republic. Fourth, the nationalization of slavery to the extent of making slavery respected in every state of the Union. Fifth, the extension of slavery over Mexico and the entire South American states. Sir, these objects are forcibly presented to us in the stern logic of passing events, in the facts which are and have been passing around us during the last 3 years. The country has been and is now dividing on these grand issues. In their magnitude, these issues cast all others into the shade, depriving them of all life and vitality. Old party ties are broken. Like is finding its like on either side of these great issues, and the great battle is at hand. For the present, the best representative of the slavery party in politics is the Democratic Party. Its great head for the present is President Pierce, whose boast it was before his election that his whole life had been consistent with the interests of slavery, that he is above reproach on that score. In his inaugural address, he reassures the South on this point. Well, the head of the slave power being in power, it is natural that the pro-slavery elements should cluster around the administration, and this is rapidly being done. A fraternization is going on. The stringent protectionists and the free traders strike hands. The supporters of Fillmore are becoming the supporters of Pierce. The silver-gray Whig shakes hands with the hunker Democrat, the former only differing from the latter in name. They are of one heart, one mind, and the union is natural and perhaps inevitable. Both hate Negroes. Both hate progress. Both hate the higher law. Both hate William H. Seward. Both hate the Free Democratic Party. And upon this hateful basis, they are forming a union of hatred. Pilate and Herod are thus made friends. Even the central organ of the Whig Party is extending its beggar hand for a morsel from the table of slavery democracy, and when spurned from the feast by the more deserving, it pockets the insult. When kicked on one side, it turns the other and perseveres in its importunities. The fact is, that paper comprehends the demands of the times. It understands the age and its issues. It wisely sees that slavery and freedom are the great antagonistic forces in the country, and it goes to its own side. Silver grays and hunkers all understand this. They are therefore rapidly sinking all other questions to nothing compared with the increasing demands of slavery. They are collecting, arranging, and consolidating their forces for the accomplishment of their appointed work. The keystone to the arch of this grand union of the Slavery Party of the United States is the Compromise of 1850. In that compromise, we have all the objects of our slaveholding policy specified. It is, sir, favorable to this view of the designs of the slave power, that both the Whig and the Democratic Party bent lower, sunk deeper and strained harder in their conventions preparatory to the late presidential election to meet the demands of the slavery party than at any previous time in their history. Never did parties come before the northern people with propositions of such undisguised contempt for the moral sentiment and the religious ideas of that people. They virtually asked them to unite in a war upon free speech and upon conscience and to drive the almighty presence from the councils of the nation. Resting their platforms upon the fugitive slave bill, they boldly asked the people for political power to execute the horrible and hell-black provisions of that bill. The history of that election reveals with great clearness the extent to which slavery has shot its leprous distillment through the lifeblood of the nation. The party most thoroughly opposed to the cause of justice and humanity triumphed, while the party suspected of a leaning toward liberty was overwhelmingly defeated, some say annihilated. But here is a still more important fact illustrating the designs of the slave power. It is a fact full of meaning that no sooner did the Democratic Slavery Party come into power than a system of legislation was presented to the legislatures of the northern states designed to put the states in harmony with the fugitive slave law and the malignant bearing of the national government toward the colored inhabitants of the country. This whole movement on the part of the states bears the evidence of having one origin, emanating from one head and urged forward by one power. It was simultaneous, uniform, and general, and looked to one end. It was intended to put thorns under feet already bleeding, to crush a people already bowed down, to enslave a people already but half free. In a word, it was intended to discourage, dishearten, and drive the free colored people out of the country. In looking at the recent black law of Illinois, one is struck dumb with its enormity. It would seem that the men who enacted that law had not only banished from their minds all sense of justice, but all sense of shame. It coolly proposes to sell the bodies and souls of the blacks to increase the intelligence and refinement of the whites, to rob every black stranger who ventures among them to increase their literary fund. While this is going on in the states, a pro-slavery political board of health is established at Washington. Senators Hale, Chase, and Sumner are robbed of a part of their senatorial dignity and consequence as representing sovereign states because they have refused to be inoculated with the slavery virus. Among the services which a senator is expected by his state to perform are many that can only be done efficiently on committees, and in saying to these honorable senators, "You shall not serve on the committees of this body," the slavery party took the responsibility of robbing and insulting the states that sent them. It is an attempt at Washington to decide for the states who shall be sent to the Senate. Sir, it strikes me that this aggression on the part of the slave power did not meet at the hands of the proscribed senators the rebuke which we had a right to expect would be administered. It seems to me that an opportunity was lost, that the great principle of senatorial equality was left undefended at a time when its vindication was sternly demanded. But it is not to the purpose of my present statement to criticize the conduct of our friends. I am persuaded that much ought to be left to the discretion of anti-slavery men in Congress, and charges of recreancy should never be made but on the most sufficient grounds. For, of all the places in the world where an anti-slavery man needs the confidence and encouragement of friends, I take Washington to be that place. Let me now call attention to the social influences which are operating and cooperating with the slavery party of the country, designed to contribute to one or all of the grand objects aimed at by that party. We see here the black man attacked in his vital interests. Prejudice and hate are excited against him. Enmity is stirred up between him and other laborers. The Irish people, warm-hearted, generous, and sympathizing with the oppressed everywhere, when they stand upon their own green island, are instantly taught on arriving in this Christian country to hate and despise the colored people. They are taught to believe that we eat the bread which of right belongs to them. The cruel lie is told the Irish that our adversity is essential to their prosperity. Sir, the Irish American will find out his mistake one day. He will find that in assuming our avocation he has also assumed our degradation. But for the present we are sufferers. The old employments by which we have heretofore gained our livelihood are gradually, and it may be inevitably passing into other hands. Every hour sees us elbowed out of some employment to make room perhaps for some newly arrived emigrants whose hunger and color are thought to give them a title to especial favor. White men are becoming house servants, cooks and stewards, common laborers and flunkies to our gentry, and, for aught I see, they adjust themselves to their stations with all becoming obsequiousness. This fact proves that if we cannot rise to the whites can fall to us. Now, sir, look once more. While the colored people are thus elbowed out of employment, while the enmity of emigrants is being excited against us, while state after state enacts laws against us, while we are hunted down like wild game and oppressed with a general feeling of insecurity, the American Colonization Society, that old offender against the best interests and slanderer of the colored people, awakens to new life and vigorously presses its scheme upon the consideration of the people and the government. New papers are started, some for the North and some for the South, and each in its tone adapting itself to its latitude. Government, state and national, is called upon for appropriations to enable the society to send us out of the country by steam. They want steamers to carry letters and Negroes to Africa. Evidently, this society looks upon our extremity as its opportunity, and we may expect that it will use the occasion well. They do not deplore but glory in our misfortunes. But, sir, I must hasten. I have thus briefly given my view of one aspect of the present condition and future prospects of the colored people of the United States, and what I have said is far from encouraging to my afflicted people. I have seen the cloud gather upon the sable brows of some who hear me. I confess the case looks black enough. Sir, I am not a hopeful man. I think I am apt even to undercalculate the benefits of the future. Yet, sir, in this seemingly desperate case, I do not despair for my people. There is a bright side to almost every picture of this kind, and ours is no exception to the general rule. If the influences against us are strong, those for us are also strong. To the inquiry, will our enemies prevail in the execution of their designs? In my God and in my soul, I believe they will not. Let us look at the first object sought for by the slavery party of the country. That is, the suppression of anti-slavery discussion. They desire to suppress discussion on this subject with a view to the peace of the slaveholder and the security of slavery. Now, sir, neither the principal nor the subordinate objects here declared can be at all gained by the slave power, and for this reason, it involves the proposition to padlock the lips of the whites in order to secure the fetters on the limbs of the blacks. The right of speech, precious and priceless, cannot, will not be surrendered to slavery. Its suppression is asked for, as I have said, to give peace and security to slaveholders. Sir, that thing cannot be done. God has interposed an insuperable obstacle to any such result. There can be no peace, saith my God to the wicked. Suppose it were possible to put down this discussion, what would it avail the guilty slaveholder, pillowed as he is upon heaving bosoms of ruined souls? He could not have a peaceful spirit. If every anti-slavery tongue in the nation were silent, every anti-slavery organization dissolved, every anti-slavery press demolished, every anti-slavery periodical, paper, book, pamphlet, or whatnot, were searched out, gathered, deliberately burned to ashes, and their ashes given to the four winds of heaven, still, the slaveholder could have no peace. In every pulsation of his heart, in every throb of his life, in every glance of his eye, in the breeze that soothes and in the thunder that startles, would be waked up an accuser whose cause is, thou art verily guilty concerning thy brother. The end of my bondage and my freedom. The Slavery Party, extracted from a speech delivered before the American Anti-Slavery Society by Frederick Douglass, and read by Rick Kistner for Litigo on the web at fcit.usf.edu.